Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. Glad you're with us today. This is, of course, Central Coast Voices, and we want to remind you that you're part of the voice that we want to share. KCBX is community public radio, and we're part of your community, and you're part of ours, and we're really all in the same community. So I want to remind you that this is a call-in program, and you are welcome to call. And I'll remind you of the number a few times, but if you get a chance to write it down, if you don't have it already, it is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. The goal of Central Coast Voices is really to bring you credible information that's valid and insightful and talks about the diversity of our community and things that are going on. It also addresses today's choices and how they affect tomorrow's community. We are a product and a part of the Action for Healthy Communities, which is a committee of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. You can see our report and information at actionslo.org. That's www.actionslo.org. It is a report that comes out every 3 years that looks at the status of the community, everything from homeless issues to community relations issues and education. And all of the information on that site is available for download, and there is no charge involved. And this is a topic that I'm bringing you to today because if you haven't noticed, the country we live in is in a bit of turmoil in a lot of areas, but one of those areas is race and ethnic relations. And since the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, and this has been rekindled a lot in the debate and how we look at race in this country. Today I have two wonderful guests with me, and we are going to talk about this very topic. I have Annie Holmes. She's the executive director of the University Diversity and Inclusivity at Cal Poly. And I have Bailey Drexler, who is a professor of human development at Cuesta College. And I'm glad they're with us today. Welcome, folks. I'm glad you got a chance to be here. We're going to get into the topic at hand and ways to look at it in a little bit. I want to give you a little bit of background on my perspective that got us here today and remind you that we are basically 50 years from the time that Martin Luther King did a speech called I Have a Dream. There's an awful lot of people in this country who believe that race relations and ethnic relations in this country are just dandy. We've lived through all of the problems, and we've overcome them all, and so doggone it, what are we talking about? There are other people who are saying, wait a minute, look at my community. Let me tell you about how I feel. Let me tell you about how included or not included I feel, and those are things that they address every day. That's why we're here today. I want to bring up an incident that I have read about. There's a gentleman named Charles Belk. The last name is spelled B-E-L-K, if you want to basically do some further research on this. Charles is a businessman. Charles is a graduate of a couple of – actually, he's got an MBA from Indiana University. He's got a bachelor's degree in engineering from University of Southern California, and he has a fellowship certificate from the educational leadership community of the Harvard Business School. Okay, so that gives you some idea what the background of Charles is. Charles is black. Charles is a large black man who I believe most of the time has either extremely short hair or has a shaved head. He's a businessman in Southern California. And on August 22nd of last year at 5:10 p.m., he was basically arrested. He was arrested because he happened to be walking on La Cienega Boulevard in Beverly Hills while the Beverly Hills Police Department was looking for the suspects for a robbery attempt, actually an armed robbery that took place at a Citibank nearby. Charles was then held for somewhere in the neighborhood of about 8 to 10 hours. He was held without any charges being listed. He was not given a chance to call an attorney for a long time. He basically sat on the curb, handcuffed with his hands behind him, in rush hour traffic in downtown Beverly Hills for a couple of hours, and then six police cars showed up, took him away, and basically questioned him rather extensively because he was the suspect in this crime. Bottom line is, because I could go on, the writing about the Charles does to chronicle this, and I have to add to this the point that one of the lucky things we have is that Charles Belk is alive to write and talk about his own story. One of the things that happened was he said he was actually leaving from a place where he was at a restaurant to go put money in his parking meter before the meter ran out. Because his cell phone went off, he slowed down to talk on his cell phone or text possibly. And he said it probably saved his life because when the cops came up, if he'd been running, he believes he would not be alive. His only activity related to that crime is he fit the description of a tall black male. By the way, if you happen to be a tall white male, I'm 6'3" and I'm an Anglo. If you happen to be a tall white male and you run down the street, you fit the description of about 60% of the people on the street. If you happen to be a tall black man in Beverly Hills, you may not fit that many people. In my mind, this is part of what we have a problem with is in this community. I could go on because I have about 2.5 pages of Charles' chronicle of the day. It took him till about midnight to get out of jail. When he finally got someone to look at the video of the bank in which the crime took place and say, oh, you don't look like this guy at all, except you're tall and black. That's all I have to say about that right now, or I'll just get angrier about it. I'm sorry. Well, ladies, you deal with this kind of question every day. I deal with it only from a standpoint of both news and information and the fact that I'm a rather politically connected person with an opinion about everything. Do we have a problem in this country? Do we not have a problem in this country? Who wants to go first?
So this is Annie, and I definitely believe that there are problems in the country. I think, as you stated, 50 years ago, civil rights movement, there was a lot of education and training and preparation for the March on Selma and for Dr. King's speech in Washington, D.C. And there was a lot of excitement and charisma around moving forward with race relations and equality and social justice. But as time has gone on, for some reason, you know, I think, you know, it's been great. Legislation has been put into place in 1965 to try to eradicate and looking at affirmative action. But there tends to be this mindset that by providing equality for those that have been historically underrepresented, we're taking something away from the majority. And so I don't know if there's this fear that's occurring in majority members where they're concerned that by providing just equal access and opportunity, that something is going to be taken from them. And so it's not an either or. It's not a dichotomy. It really is about how can we look at leveling the playing field for everyone to be successful. And so, yes, I think we still have policies that are put into place that are hindering certain communities. For instance, it kills me every time I go back to my hometown of Newark, New Jersey, and I drive around and I see school buildings boarded up, but I see prisons being built. And so why are we putting resources into prisons rather than into the education in those segregated communities?
Hi, this is Bailey, and I second what Annie is saying. And my first reaction is, well, a recent memory of a colleague saying to me, well, I think we're post-racial now. And that to me is an indication that, yes, we still have problems. Right. We have a black president in office. And for many people, that equates to being post-racial, which I guess in their mind means there's no more racist issues.
Mm-hmm. I want to jump in. That's a very good point because I really want to to some extent, maybe challenge what it means in our society. Those of us who are saying, gee, it's wonderful we have a black president. But we also have people in the society who are saying, oh, my God, we have a black president. I need to go buy more guns. I need to feel less safe. I need to challenge whether or not this man was even born in the United States. There is maybe equal number of people on both sides of that issue arguing about whether or not that has become a representation of how far we've gone, or whether or not the reaction to that is a representation of how far we haven't gone. And I'm not quite sure what we do with that. There seems to be a recurring theme when I read a lot of material it's a lot of commentary, that this isn't a racial issue, it isn't an ethnic issue, it's all an economic issue, and that's all that matters. I think when we have confrontations with the police like we've seen happen, it's not necessary. The police don't know whether or not you're a poor person or a rich person. But a lot of it is just based upon people's fears. And I'm wondering, do you deal with that, and do you see that in our community locally?
The fears?
Yeah.
Well, my perspective is very limited because I think our community is somewhat underrepresented with the larger United States. So we have a predominantly European white community, and I am white European myself. My friends of color and students of color will talk about in class and on campus at least their sense of the fear that they perceive is being imposed on them by people around them. So when a brown-skinned person goes into a clothing store and has a bag and her purse, she's being watched throughout the store, and it registers to her that this person is afraid I'm going to steal because of the color of my skin. So, I have limited personal experience of this, but what I know of reading and life experiences with people in my life, there is that fear.
And I want to make sure to connect this conversation to the statement that you made previously around, people who have seen our president and because of his background have questioned his legitimacy to be the president because of his ethnic background, the color of his skin, and all of those things. And I think, for folks to equate that to, I need to go and buy more guns, or I need to protect the sanctity of our country, is very concerning. And I think that even locally, for folks who have, I am a person of color, I am a black citizen here, born and raised in the United States, and most recently having lived in the Central Coast, and raising three black sons and married to a black man, having conversations with my husband about the fact that our experiences are even different. As a black woman, I have talked myself out of speeding tickets. As a black man, my husband always drives under the speed limit, especially when he drives my car, because it's a BMW, it's a Mercedes-Benz. And so that always having to be conscious of who you are and your identity when you step in, out of the home. We're even trying to communicate to our children. When you walk out of the house, people are going to see you, and they're going to unfortunately judge you on what they see. They don't know your parents are educated and have graduate degrees and are professionals. They don't know that you eat well every day, that you are not, one of the students at school that's getting a free or reduced lunch. They don't see that. And so I think when we're talking about race, I think, yes, there tends to be some intersections as it pertains to class, but there are still some situations where people will judge, and unfortunately, Dr. King's dream has not been realized, that people are still judged by the color of their skin and not the content of their character. Even since we've moved here, my son had an interaction with one of our neighbors. He was playing basketball in the yard with one of his friends, and his friend was actually white, and the ball rolled into the street, and my son went to get it, and as he was walking back to the home, he dribbled the ball back. Well, the neighbor came out and began to yell at him for disrupting her dog and teasing her dog while he was just getting the ball to bring it back, and he was so distraught. He really couldn't figure out what was going on. And it was even interesting to see his friend's reaction. You know, he kept saying, "Trey, you didn't do anything wrong. Everything's okay. I don't know why she was so upset with you." And so to have that conversation with an 11-year-old about how people are going to perceive you and you believe that you're not doing anything wrong, you're just going about your day, but they're making a decision about who you are and your character, and it has nothing to do with the way you carry yourself. So, you know, I think there's still some issues because you can't change everyone. And so we can't live in a post-racial society because I'm pretty sure the racists in town didn't get the memo when the president was elected that, oh, black president, no more racism, we'll quit, you know, break up the KKK, yeah, we're done.
That's a very good point. I have to interject that I am surprised that more people who have that kind of racial prejudice don't understand that they might get ridiculed by a lot of people for it. Mm-hmm. So maybe they need to be under the radar. And it's good they're not under the radar because I'd like to know my enemies.
Exactly.
Okay? I absolutely want to know my enemies. Okay. But the flip side is I'm surprised that they think that being public is somehow not going to get them some scrutiny that's looked at differently.
Can I jump in?
Yeah.
Annie's point about, for herself and her family, walking out their front door and the moment they do, and in our community, realize that they are being judged in a way that I, as a white woman, am not being judged. And I think we'll come back to this, but it really emphasizes this concept and this lived reality of the white privilege that I, for example, have. I don't have to think about running across the street, or when I got pulled over by a cop, I was very close to campus. I was running late. I was speeding. I was in the campus parking lot, and my colleague was outside, and she saw me, and I wanted to run to tell her to say, "Everything's okay, but would you open my classroom?" I had the privilege to run to her and not be shot at. And because of the clothes, and that's the class issue, mm-hmm. They handled me in a very different way. Mm-hmm. So it's privilege that I don't want to get lost in this conversation.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. And we'll get back to that in a second. I want to remind you that we're talking today about exploring race and ethnic bias and relations in the community in light of a lot of things that have gone on in our country over the last few years and especially the last few months. This is Central Coast Voices. Want to invite you to please be part of the dialogue if you would like. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. This is Community Public Radio, KCBX, and you and us are the same community. We would like you to be part of the discussion, and I thank you for joining us today. It's a very good point. I mean, there is recently another shooting of a black man who was shot, as best I can understand at this time, for the transgression of getting out of the car that he was stopped in versus staying in his seat. It struck me as very strange. I mean, now you could say, well, he didn't do what he was told. But I don't believe we live in a society where everybody has to get bossed around by the man. Okay. And the flip side is, I can tell you that I luckily have not been stopped in many years, okay? My driving has improved. I haven't been stopped for any other reason. But there was a time in my life when I learned that to some extent, you were less likely to get a ticket if you stepped out of your car so you could look at an officer eye to eye as opposed to have them lean over your window. That is something. That was something I learned was indeed effective. Now, you shouldn't get out quickly. You shouldn't dig around in your car when you're getting out. But basically just open the door and get out as the officer is walking up. But do it reasonably slowly, because when you can see someone eye to eye, you are more their equal than their inferior. Okay, and that's not a new concept. You want the look on your face.
Because I mean, we literally had that opposite conversation with our children, even though they're nowhere near ready to drive a car.
Yeah.
We had that conversation where, you know, when you get older and you drive a car, you pulled over by the police, you stop, you put your hands at 10 and 2, and if they ask for your license registration, then you communicate, okay, my license is in my pocket. I'm going to reach in my pocket now to get my – and so you're narrating what it is that you're doing so that you can avoid a misunderstanding. And I think when we see the videos of the young man who got out of his car and he was nervous and he was reaching for his wallet and the police officer shot him, the fact that the police officer got out of his car, gun raised, and shot the man during that time – but I think it's also important that we can't just look at the individual incidents, that we have to juxtapose it against the other video that's gone viral of the Caucasian man who is in the park swinging a gun at multiple police officers, and they're negotiating with him. And so when you see a man who's reaching, a black man reaching for his wallet out of his pocket, and he is shot, but then you see a white man with multiple police officers surrounding saying, please put the gun down, and he's steady waving it and cursing them out, and they continue to address him and move in to tackle him, it's hard to argue that the shooting would be justified, because we have seen examples of how you can subdue someone with a weapon.
And if I could just take a moment to acknowledge the reality of the harshness that people of color live with, particularly if they're male, and their parents who fear for their safety and their lives, I don't know that it's fully registering for a lot of white people that when you send your boys out, Annie, when they do get to the age of driving, there is this huge fear. You know, your fear for your husband. We can't just have this be a casual conversation. Mm-hmm. We have to really take a moment and explore the emotional reaction to what these lived realities are.
Yeah. And I just want to add one other piece, that this conversation in certain circles has turned into an anti-police conversation. And I have members of my family and very good friends that are police officers. And so I definitely understand both sides of, you have a family member who is suiting up, or maybe even a plainclothes officer, which is probably more dangerous, and the concern for their safety when they are working. And recently had a conversation with my cousin who's an officer, and he said it, when I am, you know, not on and I'm just driving my regular car, I am a suspect. As a black male, even though he's an officer and he's been in the force for many, many years, he knows that when he is out of uniform, he is a suspect. And so even if he has his weapon on him, he's 10 and 2. He's not getting out of his car. 10 and 2. And he is telling them, here's my badge number. I do have my weapon on me, because he knows that if they were to see that, again, they would not question, what's your background and why do you have this on you? He would be shocked just for having
it. Yeah, and even if he's shot and the person who shot him gets convicted for doing it, mm-hmm. that may not be any good if the guy's dead.
Right.
Okay, and that's part of the reality we have to look at. I think the police department probably is a good reflection of our community. Mm-hmm. It's a good reflection of authority in our community. And people challenge authority. I mean, I was raised in the 60s. I participated in anti-war protests. I would say if I were a black male participating in some kind of protest that the authorities were at now, I'd be real nervous about doing so. But it was a reasonably mixed race activity in Southern California when I lived in Los Angeles. I'm just not quite sure how safe it would be. I want to get back to one thing. As we talked about having a black president, and maybe this is an issue that we could debate forever, but I want to bring it up. The man is half white and half black by ethnic background. Technically, you might even be able to say he is 55% white as opposed to 45% black, based upon the fact that there is probably statistically a very good chance that somewhere in his father's family there is some white person that skews that. But we live in a society of if you tend to resemble being looking towards the black side of things, regardless of what percentage that is, you're black. I'm not sure when it ended, but in the state of Louisiana, at one point, if you were, I think, 1/32nd black in tracing your genealogy, you were considered legally black in Louisiana. I believe that's not the case anymore. I'm not quite sure how it's defined. But do we have a society that looks at everyone that's a little browner than they are as black? And I'll push it one step further. I know of a black individual in this county, a woman who is married to a black man, and that was not her first husband, and he is considerably blacker than she is. And in her, she has shared this before, in her black community, it was shared that, oh, he's too black for you. So even within ethnic communities, there are degrees of how we look at it. Prejudice and racism is rampant. We have countries where there are very few people we consider to be a racial minority, but they may be a religious minority. So let's see, in Ireland for a long time, you got killed by a Catholic if you were a Protestant, and you got killed by a Protestant if you were Catholic. And in this country, we would think those people might argue, but they're certainly not going to shoot each other. But I wonder, does that issue get looked at all or discussed when you're dealing with issues of race relations and racism?
Well, you know, in my classes, gender, the construction of gender, the construction of race, and social class are all interrelated. It's important to see those intersections. For our conversation, though, I really hope that we stay more focused on race, ethnicity, rather than religious minorities, because it can get so convoluted that I think we might lose some ground.
Yeah, and I agree. And maybe I was misunderstood a little bit. I don't think that's where we need to go. I'm thinking that in societies where there are very few differences among a large portion of the population, people grab a hold of their differences as the reason to not be happy with someone else. And so if you all happen to be 6'3" white guys from Southern California, we're going to argue about whether or not the people with curly hair are different for some reason than the people with straight hair, because there's more people in the room with straight hair than curly hair. I mean, I'm not saying we need to go there, but I think people bifurcate themselves in society a lot, and it basically just becomes part of the challenge. We do have a caller, and hold on, let me grab her. And it looks like, LaWanda, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. What do you want to shed on the discussion here?
Actually, I'd like to talk a little bit, it seems appropriate. We just saw the movie Selma, which focused on people in the South and Dr. King's effort to have President Johnson finally voted
right back. LaWanda, I'm going to stop you first. I'm going to stop you for a second. Are you on a speakerphone?
No, I'm on the Bluetooth.
Okay, all right. Okay, that's fine. Just continue then. Go ahead.
Okay, to sign the Voting Rights Act of 1965 into law, the terrible, terrible things that they went through before it was finally passed. And then here we are 50 years later, where the Supreme Court struck down Section 4, which was the coverage formula for states and counties were required to go to the U.S. Attorney General's office to get pre-clearance before they could change things. And it seems that we've gone back those 50 years, the progress that was made 50 years ago has been lost. And I just kind of like to have someone talk about that and get their thoughts on maybe what we can do to move ahead.
Okay. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Yeah, we have a Supreme Court that has basically said that we made enough progress that the Voting Rights Act, or a good portion of the Voting Rights Act, was not critical anymore. And LaWanda wants to know whether or not that's realistic.
I think it's very realistic. I think there are other policies that influence who has voting rights. Mm-hmm. You know, there are, if you look at the conviction rates and you look at who's been imprisoned, you'll see that high percentages of blacks and Latinos have been imprisoned. They then lose their voting rights. And so then when you start to further segregate voting locations and things like that, you're moving voting rights from those who have the opportunity to have their voice heard. And so then that's where you see reactions like we saw in Ferguson and in New York and in Oakland and L.A. because their voice is not being heard in the voting booth. So where else can they go to share their voice? It's not being heard in legislation. It's not being heard on the legal side. And so that's the way that they found to share their voice. And so, yes, I think any legislation or law that's been put forth to silence and possibly silence folks is detrimental to moving equality forward.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an ongoing discussion, and unfortunately, depending on your point of view, personally, unfortunately, I believe we have a Supreme Court that is not connected enough to daily life, and I think that's been a case of the Supreme Court, regardless of what side of the issue you are on, they're rather insulated from what I would consider to be reality. They can argue the law, but they can't argue life very well in some cases.
And the caller, LaWanda, also, I think she asked the question, you know, how can we move forward? And I think we'll come back to this question, but that's a really important question and discussion we should be having. And I think a lot of that, and not all, but for myself personally, I feel like a lot of that responsibility of moving forward in social justice requires more white involvement.
Yeah, it brings up issues of social justice, and I think judicial justice, obviously, are big factors that go hand in hand. I'm sorry I don't have the statistic, but there have been a number of cases recently of convicted people, mostly on murder charges, who have had their cases overturned based upon cases going back to court for DNA evidence. I believe in the last statistics are available for either 2012 or 2013. Nationally, there were no individuals who had their case overturned or who even brought a bona fide case to have it overturned that were successful, that were not black. So I would suggest that there is a possibility that the concept of guilt by you fit the description may be a very pervasive thing that has jeopardized people's lives in the court system also, because it's come up again and again.
And I think when we look at the justice system and we look at the system period, we have to make sure that we keep in mind the context in which the laws were created. You know, they were created at a time where blacks were not even considered human. So when you create laws that are not put into place to protect those that are actually here and need the protection, then we can't really call upon those laws when the need arises. And so when we add more legislation, I think Civil Rights Act of 1964 was great, but we have not gone back to look at what systematic efforts have been institutionalized to be racist and to be sexist and to continue to work against equality. You know, we just keep piling on these efforts to be more equal, but we're not going back to the root of the problem.
It is unfortunate to have to say this, but I can go to websites today where the material on that website still basically says, if you're black, you are less than fully human. And so we haven't gotten beyond that completely. And that's unfortunate. That's part of why we're having this discussion. We'd like to ask you to join the discussion. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. If you haven't noticed, this is about the state of race relations and ethnic bias in our community. And we have a caller. Let me see. Garland, are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
Thanks for your patience. I appreciate it.
Good. I just wanted to give some insight. I think the biggest problem is fear. For so long, our society did not recognize the minorities. And now when you look at statistics, especially in California, where minorities are outnumbering whites, fear comes into play. And because of that, we are seeing a big response of, oh, we're going to be outnumbered. We're going to be outdone on this or outdone on that. And until we put it in perspective of, again, what you guys are saying, people are people. We're all mixed. If we really want to look at the true history of all of us, we're all mixed. But we haven't come to that conclusion yet. And until our society does, we're going to continue to have a problem.
Very good point. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. Very good point. People are afraid of that which they don't know. They're afraid of that which is different. And they are – white people are now afraid of possibly being the minority. Welcome to the real world. I know a couple of people who live in San Luis County who are reasonably recent transplants from where I happen to have grown up, which is Van Nuys. And one of them said to me, there were too many people who weren't like me in Van Nuys now, and I decided to get out of town. That's a sad commentary, because for a lot of people, there's never people who are just like you.
Exactly.
And there's oftentimes people who are just like you who are not the safest people to be around, and there's sometimes people who are vastly different than you who are not the safest people to be around. And we seem to get caught up in that. The judicial system has become a big factor, and we haven't broached this topic today, but if you look at the laws in the United States, which are getting improved to some extent, if you get arrested for crack cocaine, it is a far more serious violation, a more serious amount of time in prison than if you happen to be arrested for what is commonly referred to as powder cocaine. Because crack cocaine is the cocaine of minority drug users, and powdered white cocaine is the powder of guys and gals in white shirts and ties, and therefore, it's seen very differently. Do we see that changing? I'm not an expert on the law, so I'm not quite sure. Okay, I got a note that law was revoked this year.
Reversed
it this year. Okay, thank you. Okay, it's a big factor. I mean, there are people who are still in prison, waiting for reviews of cases like that. So. Has that come up in the dialogue that you have with your student population about that, for either of you?
To some extent. My course is really ethnic identity development, and I'm a psychologist, so we look at the impact of that, of race and ethnicity on an individual and community level. We don't really address policy, but I know that
Annie? Yeah, from my perspective as an administrator, we don't particularly address legislative policy, but really just looking at access and opportunity and the experiences and perceptions and creating a safe campus climate for the students. But, I mean, it's when you talk to people of color, they definitely know, you know, that the three strikes rule and some of the other areas of legislation works against people of color versus, you know, being more helpful. But I think, you know, we again, what we're talking about is the fact that race is a social construct. And so we have been taught very early on. I mean, if we think back to when we were in preschool, you know, you take the square block and you put it in the square hole, and you don't try to put the triangle into the square hole. That's not where it goes. And so we've been taught to categorize very, very early on. And so when we see someone who does not, you know, fit within our understanding, or the opposite side of that, they fit our understanding based on media, based on some of what we've been told, information that's been shared to us that may not be truthful, then we make assumptions. And so, yes, crack cocaine is primarily within the Black community. So when you smoke it, it's, I guess, worse than when you sniff it. And so white folks, middle class, upper middle class, are usually the ones that are sniffing cocaine. And so it is seen as more of an upper class, you know, white drug versus the Black drug. And so when laws are created with that understanding, then they're created at the detriment of people of color. And so, again, even with policies at the university, you know, one can set forth a policy, but it's important to look at who is ultimately impacted by this policy. And it may not be the intent to discriminate or to hurt or harm certain groups of people, but that's where this work is so important. You have to always have folks at the table who are willing to have the conversation. And if necessary, stop the process to ensure that someone is not, that we aren't putting up barriers unintentionally that are going to keep some others from obtaining success and their dreams and a college education and a job and a home. There are just so many policies that are there to hinder certain communities.
But communities also stick together in order to feel safer or to feel more heard and understood. The proverbial, why do all the Black kids sit at the same table at lunch in school? And it has to do with how you keep your identity. One of the things, and when I looked through some of the material that both of you shared with me to prepare for this program, is the attempt to balance and work out the difference between, I want to be part of the larger community if I'm a minority, and I also want to make sure that my identity and those things that I bring to the table from my culture and my background aren't lost. It becomes a balancing act that I think is probably tough to maintain. Does that come up in your classes?
A lot. And it's this navigation and negotiation that's very subtle and nuanced that for my students of color, they haven't always been able to articulate what it is that they do when they move from the majority group and their own culture or group, ethnic group or racial group. So it's this dance that, again, as a white person, I'm just not really familiar with personally, but I can say that it's helpful for my students of color particularly and my white students when we look at that dynamic that happens between ethnic groups and, you know, the interpersonal experience, that there's, you know, differences in navigating different groups and how this code switching in a way is really sometimes a lot of work. And Annie's saying yes.
Yeah. Actually, well, I'm looking at Bailey, one of your comments was I lost track of this. Where was I here? All right, I'll get back to that. I'm sorry. We have a call from Jeremy. Let me go ahead and grab that. Jeremy, you're on with us. Thank you for your patience.
Hi. Well, I suppose I'll get back to what I originally called for when I heard we need to get back to the root of the problem. And Mr. Howard Zinn, the sainted Howard Zinn, in his book, People's History, points out quite clearly that racism was taught to us. It's not natural to be racist. It was the rich ruling class who was afraid of a poor person's rebellion who taught us to be racist. So I think that if we just turn our focus back to all hating the rich, that we could get along a lot better.
I love your point.
That's a very good point. So at what age do you think this starts?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking you, yes.
Well, I would say from day one, depending on the type of house you were brought up in. I was brought up in a diverse house. I'm half hippie, half redneck. And so I feel like I could have gone either way. Thankfully, I am my mother's son. But I would say that the messages on how I could have gone the other way started as soon as my earliest memories.
And how did you address it as a child, when you saw attitudes that were not consistent with the attitude you were raised with? Was there a way for you to address it as a child?
Other than just to embrace what my mother was really trying to teach me, which was an appreciation, a celebration of diversity. Mm-hmm. So I've just tried to stay my mother's son in that regard, I suppose.
Okay, good point. Thank you very much. And bringing up the philosophy that you've been raised with is a very good way to work with this topic, I think, for a lot of people. And I thank you for the call.
Yeah, thank you for your show. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
In our work, we call that cultural programming. And so you look at the folks or even the places, the spaces that help to form who you are. They help to form your values. They help to form your view of the world. And so often, if we actually all take some time to reflect upon our lives and the interactions that we've had in those places, spaces, and with certain people, we will see when within our own identity development, there was a shift in which we were shook a little bit because we were exposed to maybe a different viewpoint than what we may have grown up with. And so dealing internally with ourselves to rectify that and make the decision of, you know, how are we going to move forward with an understanding of who we are and how we see the world and to communicate that to others is really, really important. And so a lot of that really is, it's the external influences that help to shape that racism. And it's a learned behavior. It's not something that's innate in us. And so looking at ways in which we can continue to bring people together. And I think, you know, higher education is one of those ways. As we're working with students to encourage them to be critical thinkers, as we're encouraging them to be global citizens and to collaborate and work with others and partnership and be successful beyond higher education, that's part of our role, is to get them to see themselves, know who they are, but then to appreciate and celebrate the differences of others and working together.
Absolutely. And can I just quickly say that, you know, part of this work for me is both exhausting and sometimes I have diversity fatigue, but the idea that in my role as an instructor at Cuesta College, I have an opportunity, and my students teach me and they teach each other, that there's a place to look at, identify our own assumptions. Mm-hmm. We have the programming that Annie's talked about. We have this programming. It's not always brought to light in our mind. So that critical thinking is huge, and it raises the light, I think, that the fact that we can unlearn these thoughts, these behaviors, means that progress can be made.
And I just want to quickly point out, when you talked about it being exhausting work, you know, as a white woman, it's exhausting for you. As a black woman, it's probably triple that, just because you're always the educator. You know, you're always having to pay attention to what's coming out of your mouth. You know, being called articulate, I have never experienced seeing my white colleagues being called articulate. So, you know, just certain microaggressions, you know, that come and having to resolve those within yourself, but recognizing, yes, I am always the educator, even though I'm not, you know, ethnic studies background. And, you know, my background is all about, you know, the overall access and diversity and equity issues. But, you know, when you are a person of difference, you tend to do the exhausting work all of the time.
Yes. And Fred, I know you want to speak in, but I have to say this. You know, Annie's point is just so important. And, you know, I get to skip out on that heaviness because I don't have to teach all the time. And so that exhaustion is at least triple fold for many people of color. And I want to point out for the white listeners in our community that every time someone of color talks about what it's like to be black, brown, it's not just information. Mm-hmm. It's life experience that really is an emotional cut. They're having to relive the trauma or the pain of something that they've witnessed. It's not just information that's being shared. And I think so for a white person, we need to grasp that. Yeah. We need to really honor that.
Yeah. That's very correct. And I thank you for holding on to that point. You talk about the way that you're looked at in being a woman of color in our society. It occurred to me that I have probably often been called arrogant, over-opinionated, too assertive, but I've never been called uppity. Mm. Okay, and I think that we still live in a culture where the descriptive words that you can use about that might be okay, but I think for ethnic minorities, there are words that are far more condescending for the same message.
Yes.
And I think that becomes a large factor. We didn't get we're down to just a few more minutes, and I don't want to let this go away way too much because I want to talk about how Cal Poly has looked at some issues that have come up there before. I believe you were not on campus, not involved in campus when they had the incident out at the agricultural buildings a few years ago. But how is that kind of issue building and helping on expand the sensitivity of Cal Poly?
Well, I think that incident particularly, and yes, the Crops House incident occurred prior to my office even being in existence, but I think that was a result of it was, you know, we need to have these conversations. We need to ensure that the students of color feel safe, that they don't feel that they're being judged more harshly when they're in the classroom or even outside of the classroom, whether it be by faculty, staff, or even their other student colleagues. But now with the start of my office that was established 2 years ago, you know, there's more of a proactive effort to be strategic and pragmatic to have these conversations where it is, you know, I've heard from so many of my colleagues, you know, because I am very blatant about issues of diversity and equality and inclusion, that they were shocked because no one ever really had the conversation before. Wow. It was seen as taboo. No, we shouldn't bring it up because, you know, they're just students, and not recognizing that they're having different experiences.
Oh,
and we need to talk about that. And we need to talk about some of the white students who have never had to, you know, have never sat in a classroom with a student of color or sat in a classroom with a faculty of color, and their perceptions that they're bringing into the table, you know, when they're engaging with people who are from different backgrounds than they are. And so there's a lot of work that we are trying to do around that education. We did a campus climate survey. We have some great data from that to help us enhance some of our initiatives and efforts. We also have an Inclusive Excellence Week, which will be a week-long celebration bringing awareness to all aspects of diversity and how we can be more inclusive.
Let's not get away from that. That's going to happen in May, I think.
That is happening in May, May 8th through May 16th. And we're collaborating with Cuesta College. We're collaborating with others within the community to really make sure that diversity is no longer this taboo, I'm afraid to talk about it topic. that everyone sees that they have a role at the table when it comes to equality and social justice. There's never a point where, no matter what the topic, if the topic is race, then as Bailey pointed out, then everyone should be talking about it. It should not be a person of color conversation. White folks are just as important, at, if not more important, mm-hmm. at the at the table.
Well, I'm looking. I finally found Bailey's comment that I wanted to make sure you threw out here. And we're getting a little short on time here. It says, talking about this topic is messy, but we must talk.
Yes. Okay,
and I think that's a very key thing, and that was on one of my key lists for takeaways for us too. We're running a little bit out of time, and Annie has given us a good perspective on what's going on at Cal Poly. Bailey, you got a couple of minutes to tell us what Quest is doing and how you feel this whole discussion is going.
Yeah, well, we similarly had a student climate survey as well every 2 years in our plan and our college planning, and that's one way that informs our policy making and to have connections with students and breakout groups. We have our own sort of micro or demi workshops at Cuesta. Our funding is not as large as Cal Poly's, but we're doing work campus-wide and within the classroom. I think that in our appropriate classes, we are bringing the issues to light. So we're doing what we can at Cuesta.
Okay. That's great. I think it's a wonderful topic. I think it's unfortunate that we have to continue to have this discussion, and reality of the world is we will have this discussion forever. And I thank you for both coming here today, and I thank you for both being part of this discussion. It's been a tough topic, and we really covered as much as we can, but there's not much of an opportunity to talk about it that much. We need to make more opportunities for everyone. I think it's unfortunate that we've had some rather what I would say are horrendous conflicts that have brought about the death of some young people that shouldn't have happened. But the reality is it happened, and that's part of our society, and that's what we're going to continue with.
I quickly want to jump in, yeah. And I would wholeheartedly invite the county, our cities, to form human relations committees. There was one in the 80s that I was a part of in San Luis Obispo. We have callers who don't have a chance to speak because we've run out of time. Yeah. We know that we want to talk about this. So city officials, please create opportunities for our community to talk about this.
Okay. I thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Go over a couple of things with you. Of course, I want to remind you that this is Central Coast Voices and that we have I have been pleased to have this topic as the discussion today, and I am frustrated in my own view of the universe that this is a topic we need to discuss, but it's a reality of human nature. I want to remind you that this is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, which is a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. We do this program because we want you to be part of the discussion. For those people who called at the last minute, I'm sorry we could not get your calls in. There's just only so much time in some cases, and we'd encourage you to call again. This is not a topic that we will shelve away. It's not a discussion that we won't have some more, but we've done as much with it today as we can. Next week, Chris Kington Barker will be your host, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. Chris is going to talk about living as a transgender or as a trans on the Central Coast next week. She's going to look at both the medical and social issues related to transgender decisions that people make. She will have Jessica Lynn and Marcy Bowers with her. And Elizabeth Meyer from Cal Poly will also, I believe, be part of that discussion. It should be a very interesting topic. This is Central Coast Voices. We would really appreciate your input. You can reach us at voices@kcbx.org or by phone at 543-2323. I want to also thank our underwriting comes now from Joan Gilbert Sargent, and I appreciate her support. My guests today, Annie Holmes and Bailey Drexler, we appreciate them being with us. This is a topic that is difficult to talk about, but has to be spoken about. I thank you very much for joining us today. want to remind you that coming up next is This American Life with Ira Glass, one of my very favorite programs on KCBX. Thank you for joining us. This has been Central Coast Voices. We'll see you next week.